You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Hello again, everybody, and a very Merry Christmas to you. It's Magnus Shaw here with another edition of the Parish Council, the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. As I say, I am Magnus Shaw, and all he wants for Christmas is you. It's Terence Denham.
Made a lightning trip to Vienna. Eating chocolate cake in a bag. Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Howdy.
Yeah. Well, it's been quite a week. The world ended today.
It was a very subtle and modest affair, wasn't it?
Well, as the Mayan prophet said it would. I mean, just to let listeners know, you're not actually hearing this in the real world. You're really in a space and time vacuum. And this is all in your imagination, because the world...
Well, there's a couple of funny things cropped up about that, actually. One was some guy rented or bought a plot of land, I think maybe in Somerset, and buried a shipping container in a field, well, obviously with the doors still accessible, in order that he and his family and his friends could climb inside it and be shielded from Armageddon.
They're still in there.
Well, yeah, clearly they didn't feel the need to go and use it in the end, I don't think. Also, I noticed on the local news last night, people were stockpiling freeze-dried food in order to have sustenance post-apocalypse. And both of these things made me think, you haven't really grasped the right end of the stick here. It's the end of the world, you know. Good luck eating your pot noodles, Mr. Corpse. You know, it's the end of the world. It's not a hurricane. It's not an earthquake. It's the end of the world. Your shipping container and your freeze-dried noodles will be of little use, for they will be destroyed along with you if it's the end of the world. Anyway, it all came
to yes. Yeah, that would seem a sort of contradiction, really, to, yes, if the world itself is going to explode in flames.
Exactly.
Having a packet of crisps in a shipping container is not going to do you much good, is it?
No, there will be no crisps and no shipping container, so it's all a bit fruitless. But it just astonished me how easily led people are.
Earlier in the week, Chelsea beat Leeds 5-1, and I went to see The Wind in the Willows at the Royal Opera House and upset a stranger. How's your week been?
Well, I haven't upset any strangers, and I've had no access to football in any shape, way or form. But I did get all cultural, much like yourself. Went to see Sleeping Beauty, the Matthew Bourne contemporary ballet at Sadler's Wells.
Always a winner.
Last Sunday night. That was stupendous. Really fabulous stuff, indeed. The rest of the week has been spent just meeting deadlines. God bless those clients who sit on projects until the week before Christmas and then ask you to complete them before Christmas. So thank you for that.
sent to try you.
Certainly were. So I've done very little other than that. And then just prior to arriving for the podcast, I've been Christmas shopping. It's a one-hit deal for me. I say, that is when I'm going. And, you know, there's no popping back for more. There's no sort of three weekends in a row. It's all got to be done in one go. So,
and when you do this Christmas shopping, do you take lots of pound coins with you for the pound shop? Or hand them a note?
No, they take a debit card at the pound shop,
I see, okay.
Yes.
So all was well.
Yes, so I'll be sticking those six out-of-date chocolate oranges in the post to you any day soon.
Now, first to bring to the table this week is minutes and action points from our last meeting.
That sounds very formal. That's a very, very officious, very civil service.
I would be happy never to sit down at a table and hear those words, wouldn't you? No, let's go through the minutes and the action.
Is that a euphemism for a list of things that nobody's done since the last meeting?
That's often the case, isn't it? In any kind of meeting where you go through the action points of the last meeting, and whoever's chairing it says, and action point number one, Sarah, you were going to report back on. Oh, I see. Okay, well, we'll mark that down as outstanding. carry it over to the next meeting.
People tend to say, oh, was that me?
yeah, that's absolutely right. Oh, was that me? Was I supposed to do that? yes, it's there on the action points that we sent you a month ago.
Oh,
right. Okay. Well, I'll get that done by January. Okay, we'll carry that over.
Yeah, exactly. That is
outstanding. Exactly. Oh,
yeah,
God.
Yeah.
Anyway, on our action points, we were talking last week about HMV and their performance, or lack of positive one in the marketplace over the last 6 months.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to tell you, I don't know if you've seen this. I was watching the horse racing, and on TV, I should stress, and an advert came up for, and I couldn't believe it's HMV, and featured in this advert was it's about a 30-second advert, headphones, e-readers, tablet devices, but one thing that wasn't featured, music. It was never mentioned. No CDs, nothing.
Yeah.
So that's just reinforcing what we were talking about last week. But with your knowledge of advertising, copywriting and that world and so on, I was thinking, why, with their parlous financial situation that we discussed this last week, why are they bothering with TV advertising and how can they justify the spending?
Well, I mean, I have no privileged information about HMV at all. I mean, clearly, advertising boosts sales, which is what they will be seeking to do, particularly if they're, you know, not in great shape. And I would say shareholders and backers would be most disgruntled had they reported that they didn't bother to advertise in the run-up to Christmas. So I think they would be duty bound to undertake some marketing when the post Christmas figures come out. If they're poor, then HMV can say, "Well, you know, we gave it a shot. You know, we gave it our best attempt and ran some decent advertising." If they hadn't run the advertising, then you know the backers and the shareholders would blame the poor results on the lack of advertising. So.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. No, there's a certain logic to that.
Well, I mean, Comet were advertising their stuff, you know, a week before the sky fell in. So, an HMV on paper is still a viable business. So, there's no reason that they wouldn't run
Could it be as well? I genuinely have no idea. Could it be that they're sort of locked into these advertising arrangements from sort of months and months ago? Yep. A plan devised, you know, a year for this Christmas and. It's already paid for and set up.
Oh, quite. I mean, quite so. Back in the summer, media buyers and media sellers would have been in negotiations as to what slots were available and at what price. And it's really like airlines, you know, if you get in at the right time, you'll get your airtime cheaper than at another time. It's a real-time market, you know. You certainly don't decide last Monday that you want some airtime for your Christmas campaign. Yeah, it's all it like you say, it's all sewn up a long time previous, and the people all year round are looking to negotiate the best airtime deals in the run up to Christmas, which is the peak time to advertise certainly anything in the retail sector. So
all right. I repeat my advice, I think, from last week, which is that if by any chance your maiden aunt gives you an HMV token for Christmas, go and spend it quickly before we get too far into January.
Well, yeah.
That's all I'm
saying. I mean, my good lady wife reminded me the other day that I have some FOP records vouchers in a drawer, which befell that terrible fate that the chain went bust before I spent them. They'll have to be memorabilia.
Yes, put them in a little frame.
Yeah.
And now, talking of Christmas, which is timely as it's only a few short days away as we record this. Yeah. In our younger years, there used to be a big fuss made in the music business and in the record business of who was going to be the Christmas number one single. It was a big deal. There was all sorts of speculation and a number of acts would be in with a chance. You were never quite sure whether it would be, you know, your top running long-term acts or whether there would be a surprise hit that would come in and take the crown. And it was something that people aspired to. It made a difference and it it put you at the pinnacle for the Christmas edition of Top of the Pops, which all of the family would gather round to watch after Christmas lunch. And you know, it would be something to be sort of proud of, that you'd got the Christmas number one. In 2012, does that really matter anymore?
No, I mean, I think it really only matters to those people with a vested interest in flogging songs, doesn't it, really? It doesn't have a cultural currency anymore. You're absolutely right. I mean, years past, it would appear on the 9 o'clock news, wouldn't it? It would be an item on the 9 o'clock news. Yes. In the week leading up to the 25th of December. It would be here are the records vying for the number one slot, and they might have some comment from the artist or the record label or a DJ or whatever. And it doesn't have that cachet anymore at all. I think, you know, pop music now is not really aimed at the entire populace in the way that it was when we were younger. And it's very much aimed at the younger demographic, and I don't think the young folk really care about chart positions. It just doesn't work like that anymore. So there is an attempt to manufacture some excitement around the Christmas number one, and as with most things in entertainment, there's a very heavy dotted line back to Simon Cowell, who certainly has a vested interest in at least waving an artist about and saying, woohoo, Christmas number one. And maybe, in the last couple of years, a couple of charity records have wanted that cachet of being the Christmas number one. But it really is a minor concern and is only bandied about out of some kind of nostalgia or commercial interest.
So probably the records of these records, the record runs, yep, of some of these singles are in posterity forever and never to be beaten. For example, the Beatles had four Christmas number ones during the 1960s, and three of them were in consecutive years.
Yes.
And that was matched, I'd forgotten this, I have to say, that feat was matched by who, Magnus Shaw, in the 1990s? Who had consecutive Christmas number ones in 3 years in the 1990s?
In the 90s.
In the 1990s. Who had three consecutive number ones?
Christmas on Christmas. Could it have been Take That?
It was the Spice Girls. They had Two Become One,
yes,
Too Much and Goodbye, 96,
yeah.
97, 98.
Yes, yeah.
That completely passed me by. But here we go, Magnus Shaw, because you didn't know this. But after the uproarious success of Quiz Magnus last week.
Oh, yes.
It's reintroduced for perhaps one final outing, he says. I'll bring it back again, don't worry. one final outing of Quiz Magnus.
Oh.
And, yeah, this is one for listeners to join in with as well, because what I'm going to do is give you the name of a number one hit single at Christmas.
Yes.
And you have to tell me the year in which that was the Christmas number one.
I'm just terrible at years, but anyway.
But you won the prize last week.
Well, that was a fluke.
And that prize is safe.
the speedboat is mine.
It's safe. That's safe. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. This week, you're playing for the star prize this week is a weekend for two. So you can take Mrs. the Magnus Shaw.
Yes.
A weekend for two.
Yes.
At the Warner Holiday Camp in Minehead-on-Sea.
Okay.
So, to win that, I think I'll tell you what, I'll be really, really fair. To win this huge prize,
yes,
there's five I'm going to give you. Five songs. If you get three of them right, you win the big prize, and you'll be off with Mrs. the Magnus Shaw for that prize weekend at the Warner Holiday Camp at Minehead-on-Sea.
I'm breathless with anticipation.
Number one. I'll see how you go. If you do really badly, I might let you have a year each way. I'll see how. Number one.
Yeah.
Rolf Harris, Two Little Boys. When was that Christmas number one? And listeners, if you're joining in, listeners, no Googling.
No.
I want you to be shouting out the answer without Googling.
Well,
Well, it's too little.
How about 1966?
Ooh, I'm not going to give that to you because it was 1969.
Ah, okay, there you go. Yeah.
That's just too far away.
Too far away, yes.
Number two. Okay. Queen, Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh, 1991.
Oh, very good. You see, it's a trick, but it was in your favour.
Yes.
Because it was actually 1975
yes.
when it originally came to number one,
yes.
but it was also number one in 1991. Was that when Freddie Mercury died?
Yes, and I was working on the Wheels of Steel in some salubrious venues in the East Midlands, so I was aware of it. Being number one.
Okay, well, I'm going to give you that one. So just to bring you up to date, Magnus Schock, because I know you're beyond the edge of your seat there with regard to the weekend in February.
Oh, yeah.
It's pre-booked February, two nights, no meals included.
No.
Warner camp at Minehead on Sea.
Yes.
Okay, number three. Just to bring you up to date, that's one you got and one you didn't
yeah.
do so well on. So it's still very much in the balance. Number three, Mr. Blobby. Mr. Blobby.
Yes. This must be 1992. Christmas.
Or I'm going to give it to you. I did say I would be generous,
yeah.
and I really we're all willing you on. We all want you to win that prize. The crowd are right behind you. It was 1993.
Oh, okay. Yes, I was then working on a radio station doing a mid-morning show, and people would actually phone up because there was no text or email back then, but they would phone up and say, when are you going to play the Blobby record? And I went through the whole Christmas period without playing it for obvious reasons. Yeah.
Congratulations to you on that. So that's 2-1 to you now. So just to keep you right in the picture of that I just don't want you to get too carried away thinking about that weekend away in February at the
my bag is half packed, so
yeah. You're 2-1 up after three questions. There's two questions left and you've only got to get one of them
right.
Number four, the Beatles, Hello Goodbye. You say hello and I say goodbye. You say goodbye and I say hello. I don't know why you say goodbye, I say hello. This is really important now, Magnus Schock.
This has got to be 67.
Oh, my word. It's indeed 1967.
Right.
So you can pack those bags with Mrs. the Magnus Schock, because on a bleak February weekend, you'll be heading off, no meals included.
Great. So, does that include clean linen on the
bag? No, you have to take your own
yes,
linen and towels.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's probably a good idea.
Yeah.
Well, I can hardly wait, yes.
Yeah, 9:30 p.m. is the lock-up time, so if you're home by 9:30, you've had it for the
night. Straight after the knobbly knees competition.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we're all now delighted that you've won that surprise. So
can I take a speedboat from last week?
You can, yeah. Give it an outing.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Tie it to the back of your motorbike.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
Just to let you know that the prize is safe, so this last question is just for fun only.
Oh, okay.
So you can relax now. I don't want you to worry at all.
The sense of relief is palpable.
Yeah, this is for fun only. Shane Ward, that's my goal.
Oh, yes. Shane Ward.
Shane Ward, number one.
Yes. Yeah, well, yeah, off the back of Text Factor, but what was the year, as Simon Spates would say? But what was the year? Oh, okay. Well, we're now 2012, so...
Well spotted.
Yeah. I've only just got used to that. It's going to change, isn't it? Yeah. So, Shane Ward would be 2008?
Oh, I'm not giving you that one at all. 2005.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Well, what a good job you scored with the Beatles, because that could have been just disastrous.
I'm very surprised at how long ago that Shape record was.
I think he was the first of the Simon Cowell run, because you had Shane Ward's 2005, next year Leona Lewis, next year Leon Jackson.
Yes.
Yeah, and the next year Alexandra Burke. Then we had then the next year was the year that Joe McElderry won, but there was that campaign to get Rage Against the Machine, and they actually made it to their number one spot, killing it. And then 2010, Matt Cardle back in the Simon Cowell fold. Matt Cardle was number one with When We Collide. Last year, and if you'd have said to me who was number one last year, I wouldn't have been able to tell you. Do you know who it was?
Number one last year.
It wasn't Simon Cowell.
No, I think it was the Military Wives.
It was the Military Wives. Okay, so you've won the Star Prize. So this, I've just got one bonus one for you, only because it's one of your favourite acts.
Oh.
And I want to see how well does Magnus Shaw know his Pet Shop Boys.
Oh.
When were the Pet Shop Boys number one with Always On?
On my mind, those were in 1987.
Oh, you do know your Pet Shop Boys.
If there's anything I know, it's my Pet Shop Boys.
Pet Shop Boys, 1987 it was. So,
interesting story about that, actually, is that it never intended to be a single. ITV in Nottingham, when they used to make programmes in Nottingham, on Lenton Lane Studios there, were tasked with gathering together as many pop acts as they could to come in and cover an Elvis song for a Christmas special. So sort of Elvis at Christmas with the Stars, that kind of deal. It was like an hour special, and it was maybe a fortnight before Christmas, something like that. And they were all in the fake snow and the Santa hats and everything. And the Pet Shop Boys were one of the acts, and they chose to do Always On My Mind. And the intention was that would be the only time they'd ever do it, and it would go out as part of this show. And the reaction at Pet Shop Boys HQ and ITV and everything was so great that they whizzed it out as a single and got the Christmas number one.
Well, that's an interesting story. I had no idea.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I guess.
What's also interesting with these reflective Christmas number ones is to look at what was number two when they, you know, of course, when these other songs were number one. And what quality? I was just looking at the 1960s and the songs that were kept off the top spot in the 1960s. I'll just go through the row. I won't give you the year because it will take too long. I'll just go, Cliff Richard, The Next Time. In a row, all of these, number two at Christmas. Cliff Richard, The Next Time. The Beatles, She Loves You. Mm. Petula Clark, Downtown. Cliff Richard, Wind Me Up. Donovan, Sunshine Superman. The Beatles, Magical Mystery Tour EP. The Foundations, Build Me Up Buttercup. Kenny Rogers, The First Edition, Ruby, Don't Take Your Love to Town. Oh. And then just trickling into the 70s, McGuinness Flint, 1970, When I'm Dead and Gone, 71, T-Rex and Jeepster. Look at that run of number two songs there.
Absolutely. Were the Beatles number two vying against themselves? Were they also number one those years?
Let's get those.
Sorry, I thought you might know.
No, I've got them right here. Yes, 1963, the Beatles were at number one with I Want to Hold Your Hand, and at number two with She Loves You. And what was the other one? 1967. They were top with Hello Goodbye.
Yeah, I thought that
and
might
number
be
two
case, yeah.
with Magical Mystery Tour.
Incidentally, Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town is just a stupendous record. No, that
it's amazing
should have been number one for 10 years. It's just a fantastic record.
It's amazing. I think, and also I wonder if it's one of those records that reached, indeed, as we now know, number two in 1969, without the people buying it really listening that closely to the lyrics.
Exactly.
Bit of a doom and gloom song, if I remember right.
Oh, very much so. About a
Vietnam veteran
who's paralysed from the waist down, and therefore cannot perform his marital duties, and his missus goes into town to seek satisfaction.
And the missus indeed called Ruby.
Well, indeed, that was quite so. But I think you hit on something there, because it has a very prominent chorus, doesn't it? And I can imagine lots of cuddly old grannies just buying it to do that. Ruby bit and not paying attention to the paralyzed war veteran bit. Yeah, I think you're probably right there. Yeah.
They're all dancing to it at Christmas, not realizing the desperate doom and gloom.
Exactly.
Behind
For
sure. So that's Christmas number ones. This year, as we record this, which is the Friday, what is it, 21st?
Yes, last podcast before Christmas.
There's the race to be number one, as we were saying, it isn't really there anymore. But anyway, it's between the Justice Collective's Hillsborough charity single, He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother, and, of course, the X Factor winner, James Arthur, and Impossible.
I thought it was interesting that very quickly after its release, the profits from the James Arthur record were... It was decided they would be turned over to charity as well. I thought that.
Oh, I see.
Possibly one of the most cynical moves I've seen in a long time.
Dear.
Yeah.
A number of organisations, newspapers were running betting during the week about what was going to be the number one, and running polls and so on and so forth.
Right.
And it was featured on there was, I didn't even know this was out. Who's that astrological chap, the rather, how can I put this nicely, burly chap?
Russell Grant.
Yeah. He's got the clapping song out. Aiming for number one for Christmas.
Unnecessary records of our time.
Yeah, absolutely. But, looking at the secret midweek charts, what surprised me was, who buys these? Because at number 35, Wizard, I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day, and way up at number 19, The Pogues' Fairy Tale of New York.
Oh, well, you can see what happens, can't you? Is that don't forget that downloads are included in the in the chart, and people are, I've got folks coming round, or I just love that record, but I haven't got it on my device. Bingo, 86p or whatever, it's on your device. So that's what drives that up the chart. Nobody's going into the aforementioned HMV and saying, have you got that Wizard single? It's people downloading it because they need a copy for Christmas for one reason or another.
Yeah, yeah. It's got to be downloads, isn't it? Okay. So, I must say I'd rather have Roy Wood's Wizard at number one than James Arthur, that's going to make me look awful because they're charity records, aren't they?
Here's a question that just popped into my head about the whole downloads contribution to the chart. So, and this might actually answer the question that we raised. If I go onto iTunes now and I download Now That's What I Call Christmas, do all those tracks then get like 1 point or whatever towards the singles chart? Because what's the difference?
My lack of knowledge, but sort of guess, would be that no, they don't, because if you buy somebody's greatest hits as an album, then it doesn't have any reflection on the singles charts.
But if I went onto,
I take your point.
If I went into iTunes and found Now this is What I Call Christmas, I only downloaded the Wizard track.
Oh, I see what you mean. I'm so sorry. To be honest with you, I was looking for a piece of paper and I wasn't listening diligently as I should have.
Hold on, folks. Dear listener, just pay regard to what has just been said.
But, I wasn't listening as diligently as I should. Yes, I was looking for a piece of paper, which I've now found.
A close colleague has said here, for the record, in full audio digital splendour, I wasn't really listening. I wasn't really
only to that sentence, because I was looking for my piece of paper. I see what you mean. So if you just download one track from Now That's What I Call Christmas 2012, does it count towards the album sale or the single sale of that track?
Yeah.
What a good point.
Both way rounds, really. Yeah. If I download all the tracks from that album, do all those tracks get one credit? What's the single chart? Because they are all singles. And if not, what's the difference between me just picking one of those tracks? And then what if I pick three of them? Do they then all qualify towards the singles chart? Because if they do all qualify as one credit towards the singles chart, that would explain why old Christmas records are doing quite well in the singles chart, because they may have been downloaded as part of a compilation album.
I see what you mean. But I would still, I think, despite my grievous not listening to one sentence properly with every word, I suspect, this is my guess, I don't know, we'll have to look this up, but say you download three tracks from Now That's What I Call Christmas 2012, I would suspect that that goes towards 3/10 of the album sales of that album, rather than the three individual singles. But it's an interesting point, because if you went to iTunes and downloaded it off a different stream, if you like, as a single.
As a single, And what's the difference?
What's the difference? Absolutely. No, I totally agree. The bit of paper I was looking for, which was when I was fumbling a few minutes ago saying, oh, there were some polls in the newspapers, and then I didn't really follow that.
Oh, I thought you were just looking to blow your nose or something.
No, and then I sort of mumbled about Russell Grant. I actually have the Daily Telegraph ran a poll saying which song should be Christmas number one, and they gave 10 options, and 10th was Russell Grant with the clapping song. He managed to elicit 7 votes from the Telegraph's leaders. Number 9, Girls Aloud, Beautiful 'Cause You Love Me.
So many
people will be dedicating to me this Christmas. One Direction, Little Things at number 8. Number 7, Clive Dunn, Granddad, obviously being reissued in the sad reasons after his death. Number 6, Gabrielle Aplin, The Power of Love, from the TV advert. 5, this is the poll, it's not what we expect to be number one, but what the Telegraph readers wanted. Number 5, James Arthur. Number 4, now has this song crossed your path? The £1 Fish Man and £1 Fish.
You know about
that.
I am aware of this. He's a guy who stands on a market in Bradford or one of these Yorkshire towns, I think, and has a little song to promote,
to entice the customers.
Promotes his different products, and somebody signed him up and made a record of it.
At number 3, the Pogues. Number 2, the Justice Collective. I can't say Justice for some reason today. Justice Collective. And the Telegraph readers poll, they wanted at number 1, Alistair Griffin and the Gainsmaker Choir, I Wish For You The World.
Wow.
It must be an Olympics thing, the Games Maker.
Oh, right, I guess I really don't know that one.
No, I didn't either. No, never heard of it. So anyway, that's so well done. That's our roundup of Christmas number ones. But well done indeed for winning in 2 weeks in a row in Quiz Magnus. Oh. It's very popular with the listeners, that feature.
I thought you were going to say with the ladies, but...
No, with the Christmas number ones. You'll be going with your lady, the Mrs. Magnus Shaw, to the Warner Resort at Minehead-on-Sea in February. No meals included, bring your own linen.
It should certainly be warm on the Atlantic coast at that time.
I'm sure Mrs. the Magnus Shaw would be absolutely thrilled by this.
I'm sure she will. Knowing her very modest taste in vacations, that should just suit her to a T, shouldn't it? Yeah.
Yes, you've just come back from a California trip. I'm sure... The bracing coast of Somerset will be
just the ticket.
This week, Magnus Shaw saw the publication of the Pollard Report.
Run for your lives! Yes.
The report drafted and published by Nick Pollard, the former headman of Sky News, looking at he had a sort of, not like the Leveson Inquiry, anything like that. He was basically tasked with looking at the reasons behind the BBC's decision to drop the Newsnight investigation into the Jimmy Savile situation. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to... there's a couple of things that I want to bring to the table. One is, I don't know what your view is about Lord Patton, Chris Patton, as Director General of the BBC. But one thing that strikes me is that somebody somewhere that knows him well should have a little word with him, because when this report, Nick Pollard produced this report at a press conference and gave his summary and so on, then there were questions afterwards. The one thing I think I would have said to Lord Patton not to do is, for God's sake, don't be aggressive with the reporters here. We're a bit on the back foot at the BBC. You know, we don't have to kowtow to these journalists. But on the other hand, don't be aggressive when talking to them. And that was exactly what he did. I think it was a poor fellow from the Times asked him a question and Patton answered it. And to be fair to the journalists, didn't give a completely unequivocal answer to would they be publishing the exchange of emails that are very key to what happened about this whole Newsnight business? And Lord Patton said, well, we're going to publish everything, which is fair enough. But a trained journalist would say, okay, you know, so you might say, well, he's going to publish everything. Isn't that enough for you? But a trained journalist would say, yes, okay, but can I just clarify, does that include all the emails? Uh-huh. And Lord Patton just sort of ripped into him, and, you know, as if, you know, are you some sort of buffoon? You know, what have I just... In fact, he actually said, what have I just said? What have I just said? We're going to publish everything. Are you satisfied? He said to the Times reporter. And the chap sort of went, yeah. And that was his manner throughout. And I also took great note that he was too busy the next morning, Lord Patton, the chairman of the BBC Governors, too busy to appear on Five Live for any interviews, despite having moved its controller from his job. Or I don't know whether he was refusing to appear because he'd just moved the controller from his job and he wondered what he was going to get from Nicky Campbell or Rachel Burton. But, yeah, it just seems to me that here we have an organisation which is still probably quite, you know, well-loved and, you know, I suspect people actually want the BBC to emerge out of this and, you know, to be able to put it behind them and get on with doing what they do best, which is hopefully making good programmes. And, they're striving, like new broadcasting house, new building, and, you know, new regimes coming in all over the place, people resigning here, there and everywhere, and new people coming in. But they seem to have, forgive me, Lord Patton, a dinosaur at the top of the organisation who seems to think that answering questions or turning up on programmes to discuss major events are somehow beneath him.
Yeah, I think this is a syndrome you find with people like Lord Patton, is that they've, you know, really been in high office and in privilege for so long that they've, if they ever had it, they've lost the art of diplomacy and humility, really. I mean, as I argued in weeks past, I don't think there's any need for a Lord Patton, and certainly not a Lord Patton on the kind of fees he's attracting for chairing the Board of Governors at the BBC. There's no reason that the Board of Governors at the BBC can't be lay people and voluntary lay people at that. And I think, he exposes all that's problematic about attitudes in high management, you know, across society, in the public and private sector, that really, you know, being held to account is an enormous inconvenience, preventing one from having a rather splendid lunch with one's colleagues. And I think sometimes that just, or more often than not, leaks out quite transparently. And that's obviously what's happened here. I'd have to say the whole thing of the Pollard report is, bless the BBC, obviously a lot has gone wrong, and a lot has gone wrong at the public expense. However, you would struggle to find anywhere in the world, let alone in this country, an organisation so ready to indulge in self-flagellation as the BBC. Mm. And they've used their own outlets to absolutely roast themselves, essentially, roast each other in the public light. And whilst this speaks very well as of the you know, unbiased nature of the BBC, that they are more than willing to get stuck into themselves, there does come a point where you would really counsel them to roll it all back in a bit, because if they the intention is to move on and to do better, then at some point you need to stop, you know, running naked through the streets, which is essentially what they're doing, and say, okay, we've done what we've done, and you know, nobody's pretending that it's pretty or clever, but we're gonna ship on now, because it really has been extraordinary, the willingness of the BBC to bare its guts using its own outlets. I mean, can you imagine Fox, you know, examining their own failings in that kind of way? It is quite extraordinary, and it does speak well of the BBC, and I think it's probably that very aspect of the BBC which will see it regaining trust pretty quickly.
It's interesting you make that point, because various professionals, both in the BBC and around the BBC, were quite astonished at some of this degree of digging into themselves that you describe here. Alistair Campbell, of course, former Downing Street director of communications, tweeted on Wednesday, talk about navel gazing, Five Live switching from Prime Minister's questions to report on Newsnight. Mm. And I must admit, I found that rather strange as well. I listening to Prime Minister's questions, and we were actually halfway through Mr. Miliband's six question spree, and suddenly there's Sheila Fogarty taking us away from Prime Minister's questions to a report on the Newsnight situation. Yeah. And I couldn't help but thinking, but surely that could have waited and been run 20 minutes later after Prime Minister's questions. I suppose someone has to make that decision. What's more important, Prime Minister's questions or this report on Newsnight on the spur of the moment? So I'm not advocating any more BBC people get sacked over that decision.
But there's no small amount of paranoia. I mean, I assume part of the influence that was brought to bear on that decision was, ooh, we don't want anybody popping up and saying that we shied away from carrying our own press conference live. So, you know, because also what occurs to me, yes, the various, some parts of the BBC have gone, you know, postal on this. They've totally dropped the ball and have been exposed for it. But we must bear in mind that there are some really savage and malicious vultures circling around the BBC, even in good times, looking to drag it down. And particularly in its hour of need, there are other organisations with enormous vested interests just loving this and urging the BBC on to be much more self-doubting and undermined than it really needs to be.
You're right again there, and again it mirrors some of the reaction on Twitter at the time when the review came out, because Richard Sambrook, who's the former BBC director of global news, said deafening sound of personal axes being ground in response to the BBC Pollard review. So yes, I think you're right on the nail there.
And as I say, that some of the organisations that are really putting the boot into the BBC at the moment would not dream of being anything like as self-critical and openly contrite than the BBC have been. They would run a country mile before they did that. So there's no small amount of hypocrisy involved there as well.
There's a couple of things in a second I just want to, from the report. It's 180 pages. I have, for my sins, read
it.
But I've made a kind of couple of key points I just want to sort of bring to our attention. But just before we do that, there's just one part of it that troubles me, that's come to pass as a result of really this the whole Newsnight situation, which is... But I just simply don't understand, and I know other people in the media just don't understand this at all. Adrian Van Claveren, controller of Five Live since 2008, I think. Why has he had to go? He's being moved. Insider word is that he's being pushed to a new role at BBC Vision. So he's not been sacked. He's not done anything wrong. I mean, he's just being moved. But it is as a result of this. And this is what it seems to be, because I mean, bear in mind, you know, what has this fellow done other than bring great success and stability to Five Live? You know, great programs, brought in a series of really good, strong presenters, and it's probably doing better than it has ever done in whatever guise it's been called over the years. About a month ago, maybe 2 months ago, he was pushed into this, and he was pushed into this, a temporary role of overseeing news when all of BBC News, when the chaos was at its height, when Peter Rippon was resigning from Newsnight and all that sort of thing. And he's now seemingly sacrificed for having done this sort of 2 month sitting in role. You know, he's not actually done anything wrong. He was just put in charge for a couple of months. And because other people are being pushed sideways and out and whatever, he seems to have been caught up in the melee. I just think it's grossly unfair. And I just don't understand it.
No, I mean, such are the idiosyncrasies and vagaries of management decisions. And of course, management decisions in public bodies are a law unto themselves. I'm not sure we'll ever properly understand them. And I'm not sure the BBC have played their hand brilliantly in the wake of the revelations. And we're all prepared for, you know, what came out about Jimmy Savile and then subsequently the Lord McAlpine affair. They just didn't seem to have the... well, I suppose complacency is really the sin here, is that they didn't seem to have the rigmarole or the rigor or the systems in place to adapt to a rapidly changing and a negative situation. But I think you find that with a lot of organizations. I've certainly worked for organizations that, you know, have run extremely well and successfully, provided everything's in place. But if various rugs are pulled from under various feet, the whole thing topples like a game of Jenga. And I think that's true of a lot of organisations, not just the BBC.
I think that's absolutely true. Just the points that I wanted to bring to our attention, I'm not even sure that they're talking points as such, they're just the bits that kind of stood out for me from the report and just made me kind of wince in a way. One was about around the sort of element, I've just put sort of next to it, trust. It turns out George Entwistle refused to have an off-the-record conversation with a producer on Newsnight, Merrion Jones. And he said, in his testimony, whatever you want to say, whatever he said, to be honest, I didn't trust him to have an off-the-record conversation with me. This is the then Director General of the BBC saying that he couldn't face having a conversation with a reporter producer from Newsnight. That has just struck me as, what kind of a organisation is that? The other thing, Stephen Mitchell, who is was the BBC's deputy head of news, he's just resigned this week in the aftermath of the Pollard report. He removed the Savile investigation away from this list called the Managed Risk Programs list. And Pollard reportedly said he couldn't really explain so. And that's still sort of hanging in the air. That's a bizarre thing. I just, as I say, put a couple of other sort of marks by a couple of parts in the report, which I'm just flicking to now. It's about leadership. Pollard, again, this is so damning, this, what Pollard says here. I'll quote exactly just a couple of sentences from Pollard here. The level of chaos and confusion was even greater than was apparent at the time. Leadership and organisation seemed to be in short supply. Efforts were hampered in part by an apparent adherence to rigid management chains, which is the kind of thing you were just talking about, about that, you know, what happens in big structures, and a reluctance to bypass them. And also to confirm what you also said a few minutes ago, Pollard says, the fallout generated a great deal of disagreement and in some instances, personal animosity within the BBC. And somebody said to me during the week that there were reporters on Newsnight who would rather have given information to Sky than to have given it to Panorama, for that investigation. So, you know, I, These are just the really strange things. Oh yes, there was one last thing I wanted to just say, which was that when they were about to run those what would you call them? Those programs in praise of Sabor, the tribute. That was the word. Thank you, Magnus. I couldn't think of the word tribute. Those tribute programs shortly after Sabor died. Mm. BBC executive Nick Vaughan Barrett emailed George Entwistle twice, saying that he was very worried about these tribute programs, and to quote from his email, I feel very queasy about it. I know the real truth. There was knowledge, not just rumour, about the unsavoury side of Savile's character. What did George Entwistle have to say that? I didn't read the emails.
George Entwistle comes out of this really, really badly. And I think it's unfortunate that he's been allowed to scurry away with, yes, his tail between his legs, but also with £500,000 in his back pocket. And other people are having to face the music, face the blight on their careers, and all sorts of other blame, where I'm sure the blame spreads far and wide, but George Entwistle appears to have been completely out of his depth as Director General, and also astonishingly completely unable to put together a reasonable explanation of why he was out of his depth. I think the whole the scaffolding collapsed, and with Entwistle on top hitting the floor with a loud thud on the Today programme with John Humphreys, when he said that he wasn't aware that the Guardian had exposed various things because he was too busy writing a speech and he didn't watch the television either that night. I mean, it just comes across so appallingly badly. And he may well have got away with, oh, well, you know, they gave the chap the job. He wasn't up to it. A sort of, you know, Gordon Brown parallel. Yeah. If he hadn't walked away with £500,000 worth of our money, which I think people will just struggle to forgive for time immemorial. I really do. It was an appalling decision. It was, I still don't understand the contractual maze that they've taken us through in order to justify it. And I don't think you can justify it, because if you or I were sacked from a job we were doing tomorrow, we would walk away with sweet Fanny Adams. And I think that's what people expect.
Yes, that's quite a wide view, although just to sort of bring some balance. I mean, he was only Director General for 2 months, so
he was.
Although, you know, I agree with you that he was out of his depth, but he was only there for two months. Well, so, you know, it just seems that in many ways, I think this reflection on what George Entwistle did and didn't read and so on is from his time when he was Director of Vision.
Oh yes, and I think a lot of the blame is apportioned in that period where he did, you know, it wasn't, if he'd been an outsider who had arrived in the organisation and served 2 months and then was made to carry the can for, you know, rotten fruits that was already there, that would be unfair. But the thing is, he was very much in the management line that was supposed to be controlling programming when these events took place, so I don't think he can sort of stare around with innocent eyes and say, I've only just arrived in the job, because it was really an extension of the job he was already doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, this will run and run, but as I do to sort of summarise, really, in some ways, you know, I want the BBC to succeed and get on with just making good programmes. Yeah. So I hope sort of New Year, you know, just brings that stability that you know is so desperately needed, and some good leadership.
I couldn't agree more. And really, I would much rather see our own Her Majesty's government indulging in this kind of soul searching than the BBC, because when all is said and done, if the BBC falls down on the job, what's the worst we get? Bad programme and some licence fee money being wasted. Well, that will go on anyway. That'll always come out of the BBC. All we can hope is that the good far outweighs the bad. It would be delightful to see politicians indulging in this kind of flagellation, this self-flagellation. I'd much prefer that. And then I can just watch the telly while they do it.
This is one of those points where, again, I wish I could go back in time to sort of somewhere around when we were talking about Christmas number one singles and warn the listeners this is going to be a very long podcast and, you know, perhaps listen to it in two parts. But
hey, it's Christmas. People have got time on their hands, you know.
Sure. Okay, so I'll ignore people telling me in my ear about the time. You wanted to tell us a couple of bits and pieces about your Christmases, in the past.
Yeah, well, I just...
That you've indulged in.
The couple of things I've noticed about Christmas, the contrast between Christmas as an adult and Christmas as a child, really. And what you have to do when you grow up, I guess, is adapt to other people's expectations of Christmas. When you're a child, you have the Christmas that you're given, don't you, really?
Oh, very true, yes, you do.
Yeah.
You're not able to influence it, no.
Not really, unless you... You know, unfortunate enough to have had an unhappy childhood, you're delighted with the Christmas that you're given. I had wonderful Christmases through my childhood. But I guess you always assume that is how Christmas rolls out for everybody. And it's not really. Everybody has different takes on Christmas. And I was just thinking, but the reason it came up really was because we had a friend dropped round and they said, oh, well, I really like your tree. Your tree looks smashing. So I thought, no presents underneath it. And I said, yeah, well, there are presents all upstairs in the spare bedroom. And she says, well, what's the good in that? And I said, well, I agree with you. Because as a child, when presents were bought and wrapped, they went under the tree. Mm. And then, you know, come Christmas Day, they all started to be opened. But my daughter, you'd think from what I'm about to say that she's like, eight.
Seven.
Yeah. My daughter's nearly 22.
Right.
No, sorry. I beg your pardon. She's nearly 25. I beg your pardon. She, to this day, and this stems from her childhood, insists that there are no presents under the tree on Christmas Eve.
Oh, right.
She goes to bed and falls asleep. When she wakes up on Christmas morning, all the presents are there.
So how lovely.
So she has that moment of opening the door to the lounge, and there's the tree that was once on its own, now surrounded by presents. So that's completely different. So that's something I've had to adapt into my Christmas. It's different from my childhood. And I just thought there's all sorts of things like that that get changed. And the other thing that's really struck me in recent years is when you're, well, from birth to about, it must vary, but say about 25, up to about 25, you go to your parents or to your family for Christmas. So you lock up your flat, you have your last double scotch with your next door neighbor, and you get on a train or a bus or in your car and you go to your family for Christmas. And then almost without realizing it, sometime in your adulthood, and this has certainly happened to me, you become the place that people come to for Christmas. You are the family. And they come to you. So you become the hub. Do you see what I mean?
I do. Yes. I think that occurs in life. There's the aspect that, you know, if obviously you're lucky enough to still have your parents alive when you get a bit older, there's a tipping point when you go from being the child and they're the parents to where, and they're still in charge, even though you're an adult, they're still in charge, to where suddenly, and it happens sort of almost a sense of osmosis that the balance triggers the other way, and suddenly they're calling you and asking you for things, and then suddenly you're advising them what to do.
Absolutely, that's it's very much part of that syndrome, isn't it? And now, and it's great. It's great because now I can take to my armchair in the front room. I can surround myself with nice things to eat and the telly remote control, and my children and my wife's father and my mother will all come to me, which is terrific.
Well, that's ideal, isn't it, really?
Yes. We are now the hosts of Christmas rather than...
So your longest journey is from the dining table to your armchair.
Which is just how I like it, yes. But we are the hosts of Christmas now rather than the guests at Christmas, you know, because I think you're in the middle, aren't you? There's the elderly's want to come to you, and the youngies want to come to you. So you're the linchpin in the middle. And then, of course, as you get older and older and older, your children start will eventually become that hub, won't they? It's, but I just really noticed that. I thought, I don't go to my family for Christmas. I don't go to my folks for Christmas now. Everybody comes to me, so I must have moved into a different segment of my life, you know?
But as you alluded to there, you will sometime, I don't know, maybe in the next 10 years, move into that next segment, which is that the children will be saying, well, we'll come and pick you
That's
up.
That's right.
Don't worry. Don't worry. We'll come and pick you up and, you know, you won't have to do anything.
Yeah, well, that sounds marvellous as well. Yes.
It's quite good as well, isn't it, to be pretty honest.
You sit there, Magnus, and we'll bring you drinks. So what would you like to watch? Now, that sounds pretty good. I think it's all gravy from now on, to be honest.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that I have to say that in my extended family that gets together for Christmas, we aren't really great television watchers. We'll probably all gather for the, I think it's the Christmas Day edition of Downton Abbey. I think you know, I think that's it's a legal obligation.
I think so, yes. Yeah,
Mr. Cameron or Mr. Clegg come round and get you arrested if you don't watch.
Yeah, there'll be an inspector come round to check it's on,
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the local constabulary, you know, looking through windows. Excuse me, sir, I understand that you're watching BBC Four.
You're watching reruns of White Van Man. Where, did you realise that Downton is on the other side?
But you know, these days, every human being from the age of about 5... upwards has access to a laptop, a tablet, a television, whatever. So I think those days where families did watch a lot of television together, of course, are long gone. They're very few and far between those.
Did you have a must-see pre-Downton? Was there a must-see at Christmas when you were younger?
Well, you see, I don't think there really was. As I say, we got such a large family, and when I was younger, it was even bigger. You know, sadly, a lot of aunts and uncles have passed away. But I possibly the Morecambe and Wise
Of course it was. It absolutely was, wasn't it? That was a national event, wasn't it?
But you know, I was going to just say, as I was just saying that, one memory just came back to me. Now, this may have been before your time. Older listeners may identify with this. I don't know if you've heard of this or you were around when this was running, but I would say it was in the mid 1960s is my memory, so obviously just when you were arriving amongst us. I think it was the BBC used to do. I can remember what it was called. It's called Christmas Night with the Stars.
And
you know, and they used to run, if I remember right, and I've not researched this at all, little 15-minute bites, little 15-minute mini episodes of all the top programmes that were around then, like Hancock's Half Hour, Steptoe and Son, all of those sort of programmes. But they were written properly, and they weren't silly. They were actual episodes, but they were like mini bites.
Yeah,
the whole thing. And so you'd have about a 2-hour show. I can remember this was like having your own little Christmas cracker on TV. I do remember enjoying that. So you would have in 2 hours maybe 10, 15 programmes all squidged in, one after the other. And if I remember rightly as well, I think there was some sort of overlap where someone from Steptoe and Son would inexplicably turn up in the Liverbirds or something. It was great. I remember that. I'd love to see that.
All in favour of the crossover. There's not enough crossover on TV shows. We were just saying this the other night. It's a really, really high time that a young couple from Coronation Street do rather nicely for themselves, buy themselves a little cottage in the Yorkshire Dales, and then continue their storylines on Emmerdale. I love all that. That would be great.
That would be interesting crossover,
I think it comes from, and we've spoken about our common love for Marvel and DC comics. That's an old notion in comic book world, isn't it, that storylines will cross over from one comic book to another, and characters from one comic book will appear in another. They've done that in comic books for years. They should do it on telly. I'm loving that.
Here's the thing now, wonderful as the technology is, it's now been brought to my attention about Christmas Night with the Stars. I'm just going to give you one example of how splendid this was, because it pretty much as I described it, but it's just been brought up in front of me now. I'm going to give you the example. I'm going to give you an example from 1964. It ran from 1958 to 1972.
Right.
But inexplicably, 61, 65 and 66, they didn't do it. I can't tell you why. But anyway, 1964, Christmas Night with the Stars. Jack Warner, who was Dixon of Dock Green. He introduced the Baron Knights, the Black and White Minstrel Show, yes. Roy Castle, yeah. Billy Cotton, yeah. The Dick Emery Show, the Benny Hill Show, the Kathy Kirby Show, the Lightly Lads, Marriage Lines, which was Richard Briers, I remember, was a sitcom.
Oh, yeah.
Meet the Wife, which was a sitcom with Freddie Frinton and Thora Heard, Terry Scott and Hugh Lloyd, yeah. And the Harry Rabinowitz Orchestra.
Wow.
How fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. That,
this sort of little, 90-minute, two-hour segment.
Yes, it makes you wonder what you'd get now then. Is it my family meets Peep Show, meets The Office, meets, yes. So what would we get?
Perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
You're right. No, that would be good, though, wouldn't
well,
it?
Well, it would be interesting, wouldn't
little,
it? Yeah.
Little sort of 10, 15-minute mini versions of their sort of sitcoms or comedy
all
shows.
All anchored by Ollie Mears.
it would be your mate Ollie Mears, yeah. And singing guest Baron Knights and Kathy Kirby, so Ollie would have to do a song or two, wouldn't
well,
he?
I think he would insist on it, unfortunately, yeah.
He would, he'd have to do a duet with, somebody unlikely, Bjork.
Yeah.
Or that's really the equivalent, really.
Yeah, well, they should give it a shot. It would be a disaster, yeah. But they should give it a shot.
Ollie Mertz introduces with Sinead O'Connor, and it ends with them singing a Christmas song, yeah. With the snow falling down from the
and
roof.
And Terence, I've got the title for you. I've got it right here. It's going to be called Ollie and the Ivy.
Oh, that's fantastic! If they featured that him singing in that famous London restaurant,
you could present the whole thing from there. You could pack that famous London restaurant with the aforementioned celebrities, anchored by Mr. Mears, Ollie at the Ivy, they call it.
On the nail. There we are.
It's done and dusted. It's in the can for 2013.
We should patent that idea. I think it's a total winner.
Ollie at the Ivy.
Ollie at the Ivy, yeah, excellent. This week, several shows have been running Christmas editions, and no exception to that was our review programme for this week, which went out 9:00 p.m. ITV Thursday of this week, Thursday the 20th, live celebrity Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And I have to say, I haven't watched this programme, the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, for years. Nice. But I found an aged Chris Tarrant still yelling rather than presenting. I notice he still does it. He doesn't actually present. He yells at you.
Does.
But hold on. Here comes Des O'Connor and Lee Mack onto the set of Celebrity Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And I love this bit because they walked on to the sound of a choir, these young chaps all featured around the edge of the theatre. Television theatre. And Chris Tarrant said to Des O'Connor, well, I bet you've never walked onto a choir before. And, actually I have, said Des. And it sort of absolutely killed the moment. they obviously hadn't rehearsed that bit. Oh, yeah, well, actually I have. And everything went dead for a second. So, Chris Tarrant, there's something really unlikable about his manner. He's got this sort of belittling approach to his guests, that sort of thing that people refer to as banter. Hey, great bants. You know, that sort of banter that tumbles all too readily into nastiness. And this was the aspect that really put me off this show, the sort of irritating and demeaning nature of the host. Quick example, Des didn't understand the rules. He's probably never watched it before. And Chris sort of shouted at him and Then Chris berated Des O'Connor as they went to phone a friend and they had someone who'd won Who Wants to Be a Millionaire before. Now, even stretching imagination, Des O'Connor hadn't arranged for that person to be one of their phone a friends. The show itself had. But Chris was saying, you've got a previous winner as phone a friend, have you? In this kind of belittling way. Anyway, Des O'Connor, Lee Mack, they won £150,000 with Chris yelling in the background, Celebrity Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
I'm not really entirely sure why we still have Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. I distinctly recall the first episode. It was the first game show, I believe, on British TV where you could win £1 million. Not long after the laws were relaxed on how much a TV show could give away. And I thought, this is a great format, a really good format for a game show. It really brings the game show into the back then 20th century. It looked very modern. It was very computerized. It was very dramatic. It wasn't cheesy. It was like a game show on Blade Runner. And, of course, you had the jeopardy of could you possibly make it to a million, which even today is a huge amount of money. But here we are in 2012, and we have seen it. We've seen the format. They've played with the format a little bit. I believe they've changed the staging posts where your money's safe and to introduce a bit more jeopardy. But on the whole, it's exactly the same as the show that I watched in perhaps 1998, something like that, the very first episode. And it must still rate well, otherwise it wouldn't have survived. But just on a creative level, I can't see the point. We know what happens. Very rarely does anybody go for the million because you can opt out before you get there. And so the tension has long since gone out of it because most people don't go for the million. They're not foolish enough to take risks with the large amounts of money they've already won, even or perhaps especially when it's for charity. So I don't know why we're lumbered with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, other than to furnish Chris Tarrant's rather comfortable pension arrangements, retirement arrangements. I think it's not just jumped the shark. It jumped the shark maybe 5 years ago, and is now jumping other sea creatures 150 miles off the coast of where the shark was. I just don't see why we have Who Wants to Be a Millionaire anymore. I'm perfectly up for celebrities entertaining us, playing for money and that money going to good causes. No problem with that at all. I might not watch it, but I'm quite happy that money has been raised for good causes. But there's time for a new format. There must be a good 36 excellent formats sitting on various producers' desks for game shows. I don't know why we have to plough this same furrow over and over and over again. It's everything has come off it. And if we hadn't been reviewing it, I wouldn't have watched it. And I certainly won't watch Who Wants to Be a Millionaire any longer because, I think Deal or No Deal is getting a bit tired, and that's a wee nipper in the world of game shows. It's beyond its retirement age, and
it was very tired. Very tired format, I thought. You're right, 1998 was when it started. Unbelievably, 29 seasons of it they've had now. 580 episodes as of December 2012. And it looked very weary from the beginning to the end. And as I say, Chris Tarrant, good luck to him. 66 years old now, so, can't expect him to look youthful. But it was just his manner, I just don't like it.
No, and it's strange, isn't it? Because he was one of my childhood heroes. I mean, I
Tis was,
religiously watched Tis Was. The ground could have opened up outside the house and started swallowing the rest of the world, and I would have continued to watch Tis Was on a Saturday morning. I was an absolute addict. I had my name read out by Mr. Tarrant when I was a child on Tis Was, and remains one of the highlights of my life. And he was quite...
he was good.
Yeah, I mean, and he was very alternative, wasn't he?
He was
very good at acting in a childlike way without being juvenile. He never played the kid, but he acted in a way that kids enjoyed, you know.
He was the school teacher that all kids wanted. Exactly. He was the sort of hippie school teacher with the wild hair who did crazy things.
Yeah, the waistcoat and the status quo t-shirts and everything. Yeah. And then he sat with Sally James, who made us all feel weird in a way we didn't quite understand. And I loved Tiz Was. And, you know, I'm quite surprised that he has gone on to be, I don't know, such a sort of conservative and establishment TV presenter, because I always, you know, I figured he would probably keep that edginess that he had with Tiz Was, but it was obviously just a launching pad for him to get into proper telly. And he betrays nothing of that sort of anarchic youthfulness that he had on Tiz Was. I don't really see him as that same person at all.
I agree with you, and those were golden days. Bob Carroll, Jesus, with Spit the Dog.
Yes, yes. Lenny Henry as Trevor McDonut. And
John Gorman.
Yes, who was brilliant.
Who was very
absolutely
good.
Absolutely brilliant. Lugubrious was the word, was invented for John Gorman, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes, yeah. 1974 till 1982.
Oh, just fabulous. Just brilliant. Just the absolute exemplar of how to tap into what children like. You know, children don't want to be educated on Saturday mornings. They don't want to be presented with Chris Akabusi's gold medal to look at. They want to chuck water at each other, you know.
That's what they managed to hit on, yeah, as the delight of the thing. But of course, you know, Chris Tarrant then was in his 20s, yeah, and was, I think he had been a school teacher, hadn't he?
He'd possibly been a school teacher. Then he was a sort of roving reporter for ATV, local news in the East Midlands. He went from local news to anchoring Tiz Was, and was genius. You know, everything about Tiz Was was 100%. It was impeccable. It was absolutely superb. And I've never had so much fun watching telly. Perhaps Chris's time has been and gone, and it certainly has for his flagship show, Millionaire, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes people say, now he's conservative with a small C. I think the thing is, he comes across as if he's conservative with a big C, and that he's just arrived from the benches of the House of Lords,
quite
really,
possibly,
doesn't he?
Yes,
you know,
he does.
So establishment has he become.
Yeah.
Just to round off this Millionaire thing, it featured two people, Rosemary and Hugo. I'd never heard of either of them, but this Rosemary lady was almost as shouty as Tarrant, which made for quite a battle. Then we had half of JLS, and during their segment...
On the five in JLS.
Oh, it was the five of them. Oh, I'm so sorry. So
I just wonder which one was just his legs.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there was two of them and half a torso.
Yeah.
Okay, two-fifths of JLS. Are there five?
I don't know. There might be four. I've no idea.
But because it was live, there was no one to fix Tarrant's hair. When he was shouting, he'd run his hand through his hair. If it was recorded, a makeup lady would have dashed on and made that good. But he ended up with this kind of like punky, sticky up bit of hair. But he was still speaking down to these JLS chaps. I'm sure he was thinking, oh, you know, I've got to help these young ruffians along. But they still managed to get 50,000 for their charity. But it made me smile because all throughout their bit, he was like, oh, I've got to look at the watch, got to look at the watch. We've only got 2 minutes till it's news at 10. We're live. And yet they managed to find time to cut away to a segment, which was all about how the listeners could win £100,000 plus or something. That went on forever. And then we went on to an interminable ad break as well. So all this rushing was completely superfluous because all of the time was given over to promotional exercises. But the bit that made me really wince and made me think I'm never watching this again was right at the end, and he was getting all dramatic and looking at his watch and saying, oh, we're running out of time, and he went, stay there! He yelled at the JLS boys, even though they gave sort of no indication whatsoever they were going to rise from their rather uncomfortable-looking seats. You know how sometimes in talk shows it's a human reaction. You're on a talk show particularly, and the host says, oh, thank you very much, that's Magna Shaw, thank you, and sort of looks away to move on. And for some reason, human nature tells us to sort of get up and leave the the stage when that happens. So often the host sort of indicate, oh, just stay there for a minute, because they don't, you know, they'll be just taken off when the camera moves away from the guest sofa. And he's so used to doing that, to saying to people, you know, stay where you are, yeah, while we just do the closing bit. But it was the way he said it. It was like he was a teacher of a group of unruly 16-year-olds. Stay there! Yes. They weren't moving at all.
No. Well, yeah, and I think the panic about, you know, wrapping up in time was sort of pre-built into it, to sort of sort of whip up some kind of tension towards the end, but all to naught, really, I'm afraid. I'm glad the respective charities are going to be, you know, a bit better off in the new year, but that's as far as my enthusiasm goes, really.
As we approach the 1 hour 20 mark, can I draw your attention to the... Actually, if we are not looking at the clock this week, this has surprised me. This was brought up to me when you were talking about Tiswas. Yeah. How many episodes of Tiswas were made? I would say what I would have guessed, had you asked me. It wouldn't have been this number.
It was seasonal, wasn't it? Because my disappointment was immeasurable when it was switched to some other show in the off season. I couldn't think of anything. I was so disappointed, was I, that I can't even remember what the flip side was, you know, what the fill-in show was. But so it didn't run.
Was it with what's her name from the news quiz, the little Danish lady? What's her name?
Oh no, you see that replaced
Sandy
Toksvig. That replaced it. That was number 73, which was that came along much later. But that was good as well. That was a very good format as well. But that wasn't. I don't think that was on when Tiswas was off. I don't know what was on when Tiswas was off. Maybe just ran movies or something. So it didn't run every Saturday for all its existence.
Right. How many episodes?
Yeah, I'm gonna say 500.
Oh yeah. Well, we were at complete opposite ends, because I was gonna say something like 50 or 70.
Oh, right.
302.
Yeah. I just mathematically, it was going to have to be something in the hundreds. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Terrific. I do hope at least the majority of them are in the can somewhere, because it's quite possible, as they went out live, nobody ever bothered to tape them. So
wouldn't it be surprising, would it? There have been video compilations, but yeah. It wouldn't be surprising if they just thought, oh, we won't bother replacing this. Or
no.
Or they wiped, as they did with so many of those BBC shows in the 60s, just wiped the tape.
They absolutely
to use
the tape.
It again.
Yeah. Vintage episodes of Doctor Who, Top of the Pops, Tomorrow's World, they just recorded over them. They had to keep them, I think, under their license for a certain amount of time, didn't they? So in case there was any, you know, comeback from anything that had appeared. And once that period was up, wiped them. Yeah.
The tapes were thought to be so expensive that the tapes were worth more than your Hancock's half hour or your you know, whatever, Zed cars or whatever.
And because they would use an oxide on the tape to make it magnetic. Often they would just literally, the tape would rust and eat itself. It would just eat itself away, even if it wasn't wiped. The oxide would destroy the tape. Yeah.
As we've sort of mentioned before, haven't we, that we think we're so high tech now, but it's hard to think what the next generation will have that will make them look back at us and say, did you know what? They used to, you won't believe this, they used to save
files,
music and, yes, digitally. Yes. Can you believe it? They used to save them on a thing called a computer and then play them back.
Well, it'll all be in the cloud, won't it? But you won't need a laptop to access the cloud. You won't necessarily need a handset. You would just probably walk into your house and you'll say, cloud, faulty towers, please. And the faulty towers will somehow just appear on a wall, the nearest wall to where you're standing. That'll be it.
And then the generation after that say, yes, people used to have to speak this. Now, of course, we just think it and it appears.
Yes, the generation after that, that's right.
Yeah.
But I arrived home and the perfect film was already queued up and ready to play because I'd thought about it earlier in the day.
Or you have some sort of implant that means you just close your eyes
and
you can see whatever you want.
I think that's entirely probable. I mean, I don't mean next year, but I think that's entirely probable, is that it is neural media is entirely possible and probable. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That one scares me a bit. As soon as
Don't worry, we won't be here.
I'll be long dead. Yeah, yeah.
We won't be here. True. But think of all those wild kids in the next century closing their eyes and calling up the Rocking Vicar podcast.
Yes. Well, I'm sure it'll be a huge hit then as well.
The cloud and say, oh, I've just got to go back and listen to those podcasts again. It's straight into my ears. My implant will play it straight into my eardrum. Yeah.
And using all my years of radio presentation here in finding the perfect link, and talking of that music that they'll be playing from the Rocking Vicar podcast, what are you bringing to us this week for your presentation to the Pretend iPod, which for new listeners, I will once again say you can find on the Rocking Vicar website or on Magnus Shaw's Spotify feed. And each week we present a song, a tune, a record, to a digital file to be featured on the Pretend iPod. And then you can listen to what is now probably a year and a half's worth.
Oh, at least, yeah.
And it's a really good playlist. So what are you bringing this week?
Well, I must just also point out to those kids listening on their neural implants in the 30th century, an iPod was
paid.
Forget it, you don't need to know. Anyway, just a quickie from me, but this week, but no less high quality for that. I really know very, very little about Isabel Campbell and Mark Lanegan. In fact, all I really know is that they sound remarkably like Nancy Sinatra and Lee Hazlewood. And you'll know some of the tremendous music that came out of that pairing. The reason I've picked a track by Campbell and Lanegan is that out of nowhere, out of the blue, and I stumbled across it quite by accident, they produced what is probably now my favourite Christmas record. And I thought at least one of us should go for a Christmas record, you know, what with it being, that time of year, really. So I've picked Isabel Campbell, Mark Lanegan, Time of the Season. It's if you like Sinatra and Hazelwood stuff, then you're going to love this, because it so much has a flavour of that. It's very retro, very laid back and ambient. It's not going to scare the bejesus out of you at all. It's going to lull you into a lovely Christmassy sense of relaxation. There's some really nice references it's the only Christmas record I know that refers to Christmas shopping. So it's kind of so kitchen sinky as well. You know, it's not talking about the fantasy Christmas, but it's talking about a very real Christmas. The voices are lush and superb. It's got some lovely strings on there. And if there's a Christmas record that I shall be listening to till my very last Christmas, which I hope is many years hence, it would be this one. It just is so atmospheric and so lush and warm and cozy. It almost smells of cinnamon and baking. It's really, really good. But perhaps somebody would take the trouble to tell me a little bit more about Isabel Campbell and Mark Lanegan. Perhaps I've been a bit lazy. I could have looked it up. But really, it was just this song I enjoyed so much, I didn't necessarily need to go any further. But if somebody wants to fill me in, and certainly if somebody represents those two artists, do get in touch, because I'd love to know what they're up to, where they came from, and what else they've done. But for the time being, it's my Christmas Pretend iPod pick, and it's Time of the Season by Isabel Campbell and Mark Lanegan.
Well, the bit that I do know about Isabel Campbell is only I'm not an expert by any stretch. She was the last from Belle and Sebastian. She was in with Belle and Sebastian.
Yes, I think that was
in the back of
my head somewhere. But And obviously, yeah, one could spend an hour on the internet and learn everything about them. But I think I've subconsciously quite enjoyed not knowing that much and just loving this song, you know.
I like the similarity to Lee Hazlewood and Nancy Sinatra. That was a great pairing as well in the 60s.
Yeah, and that jumped straight out at you. I mean, I'd be amazed if Campbell and Lanegan aren't, you know, big fans of Sinatra and Hazlewood, because it certainly has that rather, sexy is such a terrible word, but that sort of intimate feel that Sinatra and Hazlewood conjured up as well, which is really nice. But it's just, for me, it's the perfect Christmas record. It's just the sound that matches Christmas perfectly. And you're good on them for that.
Well, listeners, I bring for your, and Magnus Shaw, I bring for your consideration one of the tracks that emerges from my top 10 of all time. If I'm on Desert Island Discs, this one will almost certainly be on there. Obviously, it's extraordinary that I haven't been invited onto Desert Island Discs yet. But when that day comes...
Massive oversight at the BBC. Yes,
every week. It used to be the same when This Is Your Life was on. Yeah. When that used to be on, I think it was 7 o'clock, I always used to be sort of hovering near the curtains looking out to see if there was a car or, a radio car bringing Abe and Andrews.
You know, it's one of the universal truths that if you are looking out for the big red book, it'll never come to you.
Oh, that's probably it, and that's probably the Desert Island Discs thing as well.
If you view yourself highly enough to feel worthy of going on the Desert Island Discs, then the hand of fate will pass you by. I think. Yeah,
damn it!
It's got to come as complete shock and surprise. What? Who? Me? That's what you need to adopt. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'll just have to change my mindset together then. Okay. Well, imagine a recording session for a song where all together in the studio at the same time working as backing vocalists are Stevie Wonder, Dionne Warwick, Lionel Richie, Michael McDonald, Christopher Cross, James Ingram, Kenny Loggins, Brenda Russell, and Michael Jackson. This is the backing vocals for my song this week, and they were all brought together in the studio at the same time by Quincy Jones to sing backup vocals on Donna Summer's State of Independence from 1982. It's a radical, really radical, reworking of a song by John Anderson of Yes and Vangelis from the previous year. The John Anderson version is a rather hurried-sounding mix of what we would expect, really, mystical tales of faraway dreams and merged with Vangelis. It's a sort of slightly dissonant orchestration, gentle but a bit scary at the same time. That's not the version. What we want is the version transformed in 1982 by Quincy Jones into, despite those new agey lyrics, but they work very, very well, transformed into an uplifting gospel song with a pumping synth line underneath. And by the way, did you know that Quincy Jones's middle name is Delight? He's actually called Quincy.
I didn't know that, no.
Yeah, Quincy Delight Jones Jr.
Well, how marvellous.
Is his full name. Isn't that wonderful?
Yes, it is wonderful, yes.
Delight, yes. In my case, I would have only wished for the name Angel to be added in, so it could be Terence Angel Delight.
Dacca. Maybe that's what he could have called his daughter Angel Delight.
Yeah. Angel Delight, yeah. Do they still make that? I don't know. This made me want to explore Angel Delight.
I think they do. Yes. I do know. Sorry, I'm interrupting your flow. But on a similar tack, I do know that Jermaine Jackson's son is called Jer Majesty.
Your Majesty, that's right. Yeah. That's right. For younger listeners, Angel Delight was a fantastic concoction that was sort of like a dessert on the run. It was in a packet, and a very thin packet, like a sachet, really. Mm. And you open this sachet, you put it into a mixing bowl. If I remember rightly, you put about half a pint of milk in, whisked it to a frenzy, and then you had this fantastic butterscotch or banana kind of whipped dessert.
You had to put it in the fridge then, didn't you? Didn't you then have?
Did you?
I've misremembered that.
I can't remember either, but I'd give £10 to have a taste of Angel Delight right now, I must say.
Right.
It must have been full of E numbers. It must have been gorgeous. Things tasted so much better with unnatural flavours.
I can only disagree. I always thought Angel Delight was absolutely repulsive. I loathed it.
But then you were put off those sort of desserts by your school dinner desserts.
Yes, I mean, even that aside, it really did taste like, poster paint with milk. It was horrible.
Exactly. Poster paint with milk. From the great works of Quincy Delight Jones Jr. from 1982, sounding like a track that could have been from Thriller, but with Donna Summer on vocals, absolutely outstanding performance. Reaching only number 41 on the Billboard Hot 100, it's extraordinary to think it wasn't a bigger hit in the States. Number 14 on the UK Top 40, 5 minutes and 50 seconds. Shamlababdi, Shamlamida, Donna Summer, State of Independence.
Yeah, it's a really good pick. I didn't know that lineup provided the backing vocal. That's quite something, isn't it? And I don't suppose you know whether they all performed the backing vocal together or came in at separate points.
They were all together, and we can prove that because this week, I believe, the Rocking Vicar is going to show. This has only been released in the last few months, last few weeks, I think, that Quincy Jones actually had a camera there and at the recording. And I think as the PewTube offering this week, and if you're listening to this later than the week we're recording it, it's readily available on YouTube, a film recording of all of them in the studio at the same time. But oddly, the one person missing was Donna Summer herself, because she was absent with morning sickness, because she was obviously pregnant with a child. She was with child, so she was missing. But everybody else in the studio at all time, and on this little snatch of film, you see them all there, and Stevie Wonder is the last one to join them, and it's lovely. They all come over and shake his hand, and of course, clearly, of course, he can't see who they are, so they sort of say, "Oh, hi, James Ingram, hi, Dionne Warwick, hi, Dionne." You know, it's lovely. So, all in the studio, all at the same time. Yes. And incidentally, another little bit of info for you off the top of my head from this is that get-together brought together by Quincy Jones was the precursor. It was what inspired the American Band-Aid track We Are the World, because having got everybody together for State of Independence, Quincy Jones thought, well, if I could do it for that, I can do it for the American version of Geldof's Band-Aid.
Yeah, well, I was just about to say, the next time they all met must have been for We Are the World. I was just about to say that. Interesting that crops up. Well, I'm glad he had the foresight to have a camera with him. Incredible.
It is strange because, 1982, it wouldn't have been the first thing that anybody would have thought of. And it's not a promotional video. It's a video, this short segment is of people arriving and just sort of gathering around the microphones and very informal and people greeting each other. So it must have been either something that just came into his head and he thought, golly, this is a moment I've got to get captured, or it was just a coincidence that there happened to be a guy with a camera nearby.
Well, we'll have a
movie camera, yeah.
You must get all over that when it pops up on the Rocking Vicar website and, subsequently on the YouTube, if you can't catch it on the website. Yeah, really good. Excellent. Well, thank you for that. What a marathon that has been. But like I say, it's Christmas time. People have got a bit more time on their hands, so perhaps they'll be happy enough to spend a bit more time with us. That brings the Parish Council podcast to a close, the last one before Christmas, so I'm sure my erstwhile colleague, not erstwhile, still my colleague, my respected colleague.
What do you know that I don't?
Yes, exactly. I was walking past the boss's desk and there was a P45 on it. No, slip of the tongue, my respected colleague will wish you a happy Christmas.
Yes, 1 hour 45 minutes, a world record for our podcast. But yes, have a great Christmas and see you next week, hopefully.
Yes, and the same from me. Do have a very Merry Christmas. And thank you for listening to the Rocking Vicar podcast over the last year. There's another year of them to come. Hurrah! And bye-bye.
Situation. She grabbed his car and kicked him out. Some angel. Santa Claus, baby, the clock. Tell me, what do you see? And peace and love's all around at this time of the season. You knew I'd been with dirty dogs and kissing frogs.
To a Dacom Shore Media Production.
Thank you.